Welcome to Unpacking Peanuts, the podcast where three cartoonists take an in-depth look at the greatest comic strip of all time, Peanuts by Charles M. Schulz.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the show. This is Unpacking Peanuts. I'm going to be your host for the proceedings. My name is Jimmy Gownley. I'm also the cartoonist of Amelia Rules, Seven Good Reasons Not to Grow Up, and The Dumbest Idea Ever. Joining me as always are my pals, co-hosts, and fellow cartoonists. He's a playwright, he's a composer, both for the band Complicated People, as well as for this very podcast. He's the original editor of Amelia Rules, the co-creator of the original comic book price guide, and the creator of such great strips as Strange Attractors, A Gathering of Spells, and Tangled River. It's Michael Cohen.
Say hey.
And he's the executive producer and writer of Mystery Science Theater 3000, a former vice president of Archie Comics, and the creator of the Instagram sensation Sweetest Beasts. It's Harold Buchholz.
Hello.
So we got a lot to talk about here in the second half of 1980. So I think we should probably get to it ASAP.
Sure.
So we're going to start off here, folks, with a long story, but what you're going to need to do before we get to it is, if you want to follow along, there's a couple ways you can do it. You can, first of all, go to our website, unpackingpeanuts.com, sign up for the Great Peanuts Reread, and then once a month, you will get a little newsletter sent to you by my pal Harold that will detail what we're talking about in the upcoming month. You could do that, or you could just go on over to gocomics.com, type in 1980, and when I call out a date, type it in, and away you'll go. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to start off with a longish story that's kind of important. It's where the kids go to a very strange summer camp. And some of our listeners have asked for us to cover this kind of in depth. So that's what we're going to do. And then we're going to talk about all the other great strips of 1980, which, spoiler alert, I really loved. So if you guys are ready, how about we get to it?
Sure enough.
Sure.
June 4th. Lucy is sitting in a beanbag chair watching some TV as Linus appears reading a brochure. He says to her, "This new camp we're all going to looks kind of interesting. They have guest speakers and discussion groups." Lucy, looking annoyed, looks back at the TV and says, "I don't know about those discussion groups. I like talking, but I hate listening."
Fairly common, I would think.
No one wants to listen. It's just so much more fun to just pontificate. Trust me, I know. Here's one of the things I want to focus on in this story that I'm not sure what you guys will think of, but it's about Linus. And I really like the way Linus is used in this story. And it ties back to me a little bit, more than a little bit. It ties back to me the Charlie Brown Christmas special. And, you know, Linus, the idea of Linus being able to speak some sort of higher truth or sort of understand what's going on a little bit better than the others. And I was wondering, why does it work when it works? And so I watched just the famous Lights Please scene in Charlie Brown Christmas. And it dawned on me, maybe for the first time, and this is like super obvious, so like I may be a moron, but it dawned on me the first time that the reason it works in a Charlie Brown Christmas is Charlie Brown asks, right? Yes. Charlie Brown says,
beginning.
Yeah, you're right.
At the very beginning, it's set up, but where Charlie Brown is like, he can't make sense of Christmas. And Linus replies, that's the Charlie Browniest line of all the Charlie Browns.
Right.
The Charlie Browniest. He doesn't answer the question, but at the very, and as a person who I went to film school, that was something that struck me as I was trying to understand, what does it take for people to accept your world? And one of them is, if something is going to be particularly strong or powerful or even divisive, if you plug it in at the very beginning, right, it's the whole concept of suspension of disbelief. Everybody's listening to a fictional story. It didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And you made it up. Mm-hmm. And so you're setting the rules at the beginning. And if you drop something in an hour into the story, right, or the film, and you didn't introduce it, you have a chance of losing a portion of your audience that doesn't want to accept it because it didn't follow the rules that they agreed to at the beginning. That's the thing that I learned. And I don't know if that resonates with what you were saying. Like, for example, I mean, I love the movie It's a Wonderful Life. It's my favorite movie. And, you know, the Clarence the Angel just pops up in this guy's life, who's living his life halfway through the movie. if we didn't have the opening right. scene up in heaven with these angels saying, hey, we need to do something for this guy named George Bailey, half the audience would go, what the heck? And turn it off, right? Because that's right. not the movie that they were watching.
Right.
But because it starts that way, then, you know, you can't blame the storyteller for fulfilling the promise of the movie.
Right, right.
And that's kind of, I think, you know, whoever was pulling this together, who knows if that was baked in at the beginning, but at some point they figured out, hey, you know, if this is really what this is about, what is, can someone please tell me what A Charlie Brown Christmas is all about?
Right.
You know, you really do have to introduce it somehow in the beginning so that it's a fulfillment of the promise of the story. That's the way I would look at it.
Right. Well, now this is a slightly off topic, but I'm interested to see, as we have mentioned in earlier episodes, I talked Michael into reading Infinite Jest.
Yeah.
And there is a moment about 600 and some pages into the book where something strange happens. On reflection, you realize, oh, this has been baked in the whole time, but it's so baked in so minorly that you don't notice it until it's there and you sort of have to think about it. June 5th. So the gang is getting on the old school bus off to summer camp. Sally, who is having none of it, is yelling, "This is ridiculous. Why do we let them do this to us every summer?" She's ranting now to Eudora on the bus. "As soon as school is out, they ship us off to some stupid camp. We don't even know where the camp is." That's a bad sign. "I'll bet there isn't a soul who has any idea where we're going." And then in the last panel, we see Snoopy as the World War One flying ace aboard the bus, saying, "Here's the World War One flying ace riding across northern France on a troop train." Well, this to me just also seems to call back the war experience and the idea of him off the camp. I think so much of his anti-camp stuff feels like it's secretly anti going off to the army stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Could be. I mean, it's not like anyone has a choice in these matters.
Right. When you actually think about how little choice you have in all of these matters of life, especially, you know, as a kid or as a conscript into the army, you have very little choice.
Yeah, that's baked into being a kid, right?
I mean, I did not have parents who were determined to ship me off to camp.
Right.
Thank
you. Me neither.
Yeah, me neither. Thank
you. But it is interesting when you think about people, you know, sending their kids off to camp or school for that matter. And, you know, there's no way you can know what those kids are going to experience. You got a sense of it. And maybe, you know, people who are teaching and you get some of the stuff come back, but that's, you know, it's a pretty modern concept that the child goes off and has an independent education, essentially, mm-hmm. wherever they go. Right.
Right.
That is an independent experience. It just didn't really happen until, you know, 100 years or so ago. You know, generally you were living with your family and you didn't have public education where everybody's going off.
Not quite true. I mean, in England with boarding schools, I think
they shipped
the kids off as soon as they could.
To some really bad effect, right? For some kids, right? But yeah, it was like, but that's still certainly an exception to the rule. And it's interesting to think about it. It's like, yeah, your parents in the household are generally super involved in where things go and there are boundaries. But, you know, when you send them off for others to educate them, there's a wide range of stuff that can happen, right?
That's a very, very diplomatic way to put it. You have no idea what's going to happen, right? No idea. Here's another thing I thought that is related to this sort of thing. You know, there's going to be lecturers and there's discussion groups at this camp, right?
Mm-hmm.
Anybody who stands up in front of a group and starts talking has automatic authority. And yeah. When you're a kid in a situation like this, you have even more respect for that authority or whatever. And a lot of times it's completely unwarranted. Can I tell a goofy story about me on the YouTube?
Yeah.
One of my favorite things to do on YouTube is listen to dead people give lectures. So I find some semi-famous or famous figure from the past who's done lectures, and I listened to all their lectures. And I was listening to this one guy, and I'm like, this guy gets it. And it seemed like anything he talked about, he knew. He's like, in the ancient Aztecs, I'm like, wow, he knows that. And the indigenous people of what, he knows everything, right? And then it pops up, recommended for me. Jimmy, the guy you like, talks about Finnegan's Wake by James Joyce. I'm like, oh, the mothership is calling me home. The first line, he goes, well, Finnegan's Wake is, of course, the great British writer James Joyce's magnum. The great, what did you say? Unsubscribe. Thumbs down. Angry comment. But, like, I listened to, like, 8 hours of this guy, and now I'm thinking, maybe he knows nothing about anything. It could be like listening to dozens of hours of a podcast and finding out that three hosts don't know what a fluoron is, you know? And you're like, why am I listening to this? But so it continues. June 9th, Sally is lying in her bunk reading a comic book, and Eudora comes up and says, you better put that away, Sally. They don't allow comic books in this camp. Sally bolts right upright in her bunk and says, you're kidding. Eudora goes, nope, they say it's not suitable reading. Sally puts it away in a little box and says, that's ridiculous. Half the fun of going to camp is lying on your bunk reading comic books. Eudora says, what's the other half? And Sally says, sitting under a tree reading comic book.
Well, there's really no argument there.
No, Sally gets it. Sally totally gets it.
Yeah, unfortunately, her education is not going very well.
Why?
Well, she's not doing very well in school.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes.
So comic books cannot teach you everything. Most things, though.
Oh, I don't know about that. I learned all about quantum physics from Stan Lee and stuff. So, you know, I think I'm pretty much grounded in that. Oh, my gosh. I love Sally sitting there reading her little comic book. And I love that Schultz calls out comics in 1980, even, because it's not like comic books were a big thing at that particular time. That was probably like the nadir.
Kids were not reading comics, because she's probably reading like an Alan Moore comic or something.
In 1980, I guess she could be reading Daredevil by Frank Miller.
Yeah, comics were such a big part of the culture when Schultz was growing up. He was like right in the sweet spot, I think, of when comic books kind of became a big part of American culture. And certainly they were big for me, and I'm guessing for you guys, but maybe not so much for most people by 1980.
Yeah, by reading Lady Death or something like that.
that's later, I hope.
Or a reprint of a Bugs Bunny cartoon that had been published in 1957. And yeah, they're just kind of limping along.
I remember I got a Gold Key comic once, and then like a few months later got another, like, or someone bought me a Gold Key comic, and it was a different issue, different cover, same comic inside. I was like, wait a second, what is going on here? Gold Key.
we actually had a real brouhaha at Archie Comics when I was there. I was there from 2010 to 2016, and we were turning out like these digests. You used to see them. I mean, they still are around at the supermarket checkouts. And they were generally collections of stories. You might have a new story at the beginning, and then everything else is reprints. And we had this huge library of 70 years of reprints, and they pretty judiciously put stuff in from wherever. Mm-hmm. And we didn't curate it per se. Mm-hmm. So you would just have a collection of Archie. So there wasn't a whole lot to define each of those digests. And by some mistake that they were trying to forensically figure out how on earth it happened, two issues in a row had the same cover.
Oh my gosh.
and it was like the alarm bells went off. How did this happen? Because there's obviously nothing to identify the contents by the cover.
Right.
And somehow the same cover was assigned to two consecutive issues, and we heard not a peep in the marketplace. It was all internal when we realized that we came in and we're like, what? Yeah, we're going nuts. And it's like, you know, not a blip, not a comment, not a mention online. We didn't see anybody go, hey, I saw it. It's like you're saying, oh, there's two. This is the flip of that, where it's like the same cover and two different interiors. Nobody noticed.
June 11th, All right. Things are starting to get serious here. It's night. Eudora, Lucy, and Sally are all tucked in their bunks. Well, Eudora and Lucy are tucked in. Sally is sitting upright ranting. She goes, bed check? What in the world is a bed check? It's trouble, Sally. That's what it is. Then Lucy says to her, the counselors have to come around and see that we're all tucked in. Then Eudora says, maybe they think we're all going to run away or something. Sally rolls over. You could just tell that she rolled over angrily and says, I think it's just another one of their penny annoyances.
What is with penny? It's petty, isn't it?
Yeah. Is that the joke? Well, I was wondering that. I thought it was petty annoyances. I must be wrong. But now that you say it, that must be part of the joke, right?
Yeah, I just did sort of red petty.
Right.
It's now right, like right, I read. Yeah. Is that a typo? What is that?
I don't know. Harold, thoughts?
I would think that's Schultz's joke.
The joke. She gets it wrong because she always gets things wrong like that. Like, right.
Yeah.
Now, my other question is, check out Lucy in bed in panel 2. That looks like a lot of brush strokes to me. Or maybe it's like a really thick pen line or something. But those marks that are indicating the folds in the bed, and well, actually all the way through panel 2, 3, and 4. When you contrast them the way the bed clothes are drawn in panel 1, he's definitely either using a different tool or using his Radio 914 in a completely different way.
Yeah, those really are some dark strokes. Now, he's been filling in some heavy blacks as well, so I'm guessing maybe he does have a brush around to speed up his process, and he went ahead and added a little bit to the bedspreads. I mean, that's complete guess. But he's got lots of black backgrounds for like 4 days in a row, which is not typical.
Right. All right, now here's where things get really weird. Now, in between, we see that Marcy and Peppermint Patty have also arrived at this camp. So it's the whole gang. And now they're sitting out around the campfire at night, and they have either their guest speaker or a speaker for the camp. And here's where the meat of the thing comes in. Peppermint Patty looks truly terrified with that hair. It says, did you hear what that speaker said, Marcy? He said the world is coming to an end. He said we're in the last days. Peppermint Patty looks absolutely horrified by this. They walk away, Peppermint Patty's hair standing straight up. I'm not sure we can believe everything we hear, sir, says Marcy. Snoopy is walking along behind them now in his World War I flying ace garb, and he says, I've heard talk around headquarters about a big enemy push at Below Wood. So this is where it becomes what it's about. So the gist of the thing is here, the camp is telling the kids that it is the end of the world. And for years, I wondered what this was about. I thought it was about something else. There was a thing in the 70s called Stay Alive Till 75, because there was a prophecy that the world would end in 1975.
Well, there's something else going on here in Schultz's life that I think maybe is him. He's processing some things. I'm not saying this is the only thing that he's processing, but his daughter Amy is 24 years old this year, and she joined the LDS Church, the Latter-day Saints Church, 2 years prior. And I believe it was this year, or maybe the end of the previous year or the beginning of this year, that she had committed to go on a mission to England. And so there were aspects of Schultz's faith that he now shared with somebody who took her faith seriously within the family. But there were also aspects that were at odds with his more traditional Christian faith. And I'm guessing he was processing that, at least in part here. And he would talk with her about this a lot from what Amy shares.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's really interesting. And that, you know, this goes back to talking about the Stephen Lynn book, which I think is a beautiful book. And it talks a little bit, especially towards the end, about what you're talking about and, you know, his relationship with his daughter and how that did bring them closer together in some ways. But like, I grew up in a town, you know, and I'm like I probably mentioned before, I was raised Catholic. And my town, when I lived there, was 2,400 people. And there were two Catholic churches, huge, beautiful Catholic churches with stained glass windows and the bells and the everything. And the reason
two of them.
Well, yeah, yeah. You ready? Why? Because you can't expect Lithuanian people to sit in the same church as Irish people.
Oh,
so this is like West Side Story.
Yeah, but with stupider differences. And the point I'm making, there's no difference. You know, this is something, these are people who believe the same thing, and they can't just hang out. It's one, Schultz is a model of being able to just have an actual conversation and treat everybody with respect, it seems, in his life, but you certainly see it in his characters. You know, he never made someone else. It's very rarely, anyway, is someone just a one note straw man or something like that.
Yeah. And part of that is certainly his demeanor. I think it's also part of his sense of duty within the strip. It's strange. He's a mixture of personal conviction that he's not going to compromise, mixed with a sense of obligation to those who don't believe the things that he believes when it comes to being in this public platform. And this really was a thing, I think, in these kind of mid-century art forms. Like, one of the big arguments, going back to the concept of film, was half the people, or more than half the people, I think, saw that this was a town square experience. You know, you come down to the square and you go into the movie theater, and it's kind of a community event. And so therefore there should be some sort of a community spirit to what's on the screen, which is what led to something like the Hays Code in the 30s that lasted through the 50s, really, for any major impact, where, you know, people look back on it today and say, my gosh, you know, why would they want to censor movies? And certainly there's lots of reasons for that, but one of them is this concept that I don't think we have so much now, that this is a community town square thing, and it should kind of represent the standards. It's like the standards and practices in TV as well, but certainly in newspapers as well. It was the sense that this is often, these papers were for a single paper, represented the whole community. Schultz didn't feel like it was right to put a very specific point on something and say this is the way it is, because he realized that it was, you know, there has to be some kind of community agreement as to what we speak of and what we don't speak of, depending on our role. And as a cartoonist and a comic strip, he honored that. And so it's an interesting mix for him. He's trying to be true to who he is and the things that he's interested in speaking of, but he's not interested in trying to, you know, beat somebody over the head with an opinion.
Right. The other thing I think he might be processing is this prediction by a guy named Leland Jensen, who was, this is all from Wikipedia, so, you know, take it with a grain of salt, but he was the leader of a small apocalyptic cult called the Baha'is under the provisions of the covenant, which is not, he was actually excommunicated from the larger Baha'i faith, and he had a follower, he had about 150, 200 followers, and he predicted the world would end on April 29th. So when would Schultz have been writing these then, Harold?
So I think for the dailies, it was typically, he had to have them in like 4 weeks before. So that lines up with what you're talking about.
Yeah. But I wonder if this is one of the things he was talking about. And I think what's interesting, if it is, or if it's partly this and partly what Harold's saying, or both, or whatever, he's smart to not say it directly. Because I've been reading a fair amount of Doonesbury lately, which I really do love. I think it's a wonderful comic strip. But you're reading something that feels just unbelievably dated, because it's all about stuff that's really happening in the day, you know, and it's a great record of that. But this isn't. This is a parable. This is not a fairy tale, but some sort of fable or story that you can listen to or read at any point, and it'll still have relevance. So I admire that he was able to do that too. I think it's a smart way to attack this kind of thing.
I don't know if there's necessarily a triggering event here. I mean, there probably hasn't been a year in history where there wasn't a doomsday cult.
Well, there are 1,500 predictions on Wikipedia, wherever I look, there was 1,500 named predictions for the end of the world starting in 60 CE.
I do get the sense that Schultz, again, is processing, given how long this sequence goes. He's got a lot of thoughts to go through in this. And he includes the whole cast. And it's not like just a one-off because he read a newspaper article necessarily. It's like
there's something
I think that he's deeply processing.
Yeah. But then again, I think it's pretty gentle because he doesn't parody the speaker. You don't even know who the speaker is.
Yes.
It's all the kids' responses to being exposed.
Pogo would have a character out there preaching.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And it would be a caricature of the guy, but he'd be a muskrat or whatever. Yeah, right.
So, reading this, because, you guys were talking about this sequence, and I found it pretty tame.
I did, too. And yet it's a weird mixture of being tame, but also talking about a very weighty matter. You know,
he's
kind of kid gloves, you know, but he's not stepping away from it. I mean, he didn't have to bring this up at all. Right. He obviously wanted to, and he wanted to spend quite a bit of time on it and how it impacts children.
Yes.
I mean, that's to me what this is all about.
Yeah. Yes. But, having lived through, the Cuban Missile Crisis, that even though that was a political thing and not a religious thing. It was the same thing, pretty much thought the world was going to end.
Right. Yeah.
You know what this makes me think of in my own life? I remember when I was working on the Iraq War issue of Amelia, The Things I Cannot Change. And I felt, just the Iraq War was huge. It was just the cultural, it was just going on. It was never ending. Everybody was thinking about it, and everybody had really intense opinions. And I had really intense opinions, but there was no point in me putting my intense opinion in a comic about whether the Iraq War was right or wrong or what it was, the world did not need that from me. But what I did notice while I was thinking about it is like, whether or not it's right or wrong, my buddy's going and his kids have no say in it. And that sucks for them. And it doesn't suck because of my friend. My friend made a commitment to this country. And then we, rightly or wrongly, said, this is what you need to do. It has nothing to do with the person who's in the, his position. But the fact is the kids have nothing to say about it. And that really sucks.
And that makes it a timeless story, right?
It's
about children who are in the sway of a larger history that they can't control.
Right.
And that is happening all the time. And so that does make a story much more timeless because it's a universal experience.
So I'm interested, Michael. So you feel, when you heard, you hadn't read this, but you heard us talking about it and you thought it would, so it was different than what you expected it to be.
It's not something I would pull out as a notable Peanuts segment. I mean, it's not a bad one, but it doesn't really wrap up. Doesn't wrap up in a satisfying. Oh well, one of your favorite strips wraps it up nicely.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think two of them. We'll get there. We'll get there.
Okay.
All right. So it's June 13th. Peppermint Patty is still freaking out. So she's in bed. She's staring at the ceiling, wide-eyed. Marcy's listening to her. Peppermint Patty says, I can't sleep for worrying about what that speaker said, Marcy. I'm scared. Peppermint Patty sits up. What if the world comes to an end tonight, Marcy? Marcy sits up and goes, I promise there'll be a tomorrow, sir. In fact, it's already tomorrow in Australia. Peppermint Patty rolls over and said, he said we're in the last days, Marcy. Marcy very calmly says, go to sleep, sir. The sun is shining in Australia. This reminds me of Y2K.
The odds are on Marcy's side here.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. If you're playing the odds, go with Marcy. I remember Y2K, though, when it happened, right? And the first ABC reporter was like, first thing they did, went to an ATM and goes, oh, it still works. The world is still here. And it's like, that's who you're worried about, withdrawing money from your checking account?
Well, it reminds me of that earlier strip when I can't remember who was watching TV and they were watching, I think it was a football game. And the announcer goes, there's no tomorrow.
Oh, yes.
They all end up in the doghouse. Freaked out, running through, there's no tomorrow. They just said it on TV. Very, very much similar to this. I mean, Schultz And Schultz is a guy we know who lived with anxieties, right? That's no secret.
Yes.
But this was a man who thought deeply about a lot of things, and that in his case led to quite a bit of anxiety, staying up late at night, just like we're seeing Peppermint Patty. And you do get this sense, like there's kind of this protective fatherly sense in the strip here, where it's like he's trying to show the impact that words can have, particularly on children. That to me is the core of this strip sequence is, you know, if you're going to be talking about things that are this heavy and this extreme, just take note at are you giving the child something the child can process, or are you just laying something on them that they cannot, you're not getting them to the other side of whatever you're trying to get them to. And they're falling short here. And Schultz is, there's definitely a feeling that Schultz is saying, hey, you gotta be careful about this. Cause you're putting something on a child that a child maybe can't.
Yeah. But first process. Of all, we've kind of agreed this strip is not being read by children. Not being read by 5-year-olds.
Yeah, but I think he's still talking about kids.
About kids. But, come on, the New Yorker has been running cartoons, for 50 years with a guy standing on the corner saying the end is nigh. I mean, it was just such a cliche that, some crazy guy thinks the world's going to end.
Yeah, but I think the difference with this is that it is kids that are processing it.
And it is authorities speaking to them, like you were saying, Jimmy. It's someone who stands up in front of them.
Yeah.
This is the reason they're there.
And they were put there by people.
And apparently by parents who don't have any idea what they
so
just
what's
sent
with
their
the kids. Parents? Let's talk about why the parents send them to this crazy camp.
I think that is outside his interest and just doesn't deal with that. I also think, I don't know.
Except to make a parent think twice about, are you sending your kids? What are you having them be taught? And are they in a position to benefit or possibly be damaged by what they learn?
And I don't mean this to be like an anti-camp screed. I went to basketball camp, but it wasn't a sleepover. It was just a few hours a day. So that was fine. But I know people that went to sleepover basketball camps, and they sounded like complete horror shows to me, and the parents had no idea. I don't even think the kids would tell their parents what happened afterwards. It was just great.
Talking about boarding schools. Oh, my gosh. There are so many horror stories of boarding schools and
the wall.
these structures where you're there for weeks on end, and there are these rules that are set up by the school. But then there are the rules within where the kids are hanging out, and there are these hierarchies that get set up, and you don't have parents there.
Okay. Wait a second. I went to 5 years of summer camp and 4 years of boarding school, and it really is not the horror show that you're describing.
But there are horror shows. I mean, you would agree that there are people.
Yes, but there are also, it's also a really wonderful place for some people.
Yeah, I'm sure that is true.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Yes. Absolutely. And thank you for saying that, Liz. Yeah. We're not saying that.
No. Here's another thing that's wrong with them. I'm just kidding. Well,
but
I have heard
so many, many stories of people who, as children, are away from family for extended periods of time, and it's incredibly hard on them, and it affects them for the rest of their life in a negative way as well as a positive way.
I feel like when people ask about Catholic school, did you like it? Was it good? I don't know. It was like anything else. There were great parts of it and there were terrible parts of it. And I'm sure that's true of any type of the situation,
And there's some families that it's good to get away from.
That's true.
You're
Harry
much
Potter
better.
Situation, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Liz, you're absolutely right. There's certain people who I think have been saved, their lives were saved by having a chance to get some perspective outside of a home that was really, really difficult.
June 14th. It's the whole gang sitting in their little director's chairs or folding chairs listening to another speaker. But this time Linus pipes up and he says, "Yes, sir. Jeremiah was a prophet. You might also call him our first political cartoonist." He continues, "What I like about this next panel, though, is the blank stare on Peppermint Patty's face in the background." Linus continues, "He didn't draw pictures, but his actions pointed out certain political truths for that time. The linen waistcloth business, for instance, and the yoke he wore, and the book that he threw into the water." And Sally, sitting next to Linus, beams and says, "My sweet Babu knows a lot." And Linus says, "I'm not her sweet Babu." Now, you guys both said that you felt over the last several years. Schultz had lost a little focus with Linus. I'm going to pose a counterpoint to that and see if you guys listen to it. I think this goes back to my knuckleball idea. He's doling this stuff out, and he has a lot of different things he can use. He still has his fastball, but he can't use it all the time. Because actually, if you use a fastball all the time, it doesn't even look fast anymore. And I think that was what was happening in those early years after A Charlie Brown Christmas, where he would try to repeat that thing that everyone loved in the Sunday pages for the next like 2 years or 3 years. And it always felt like, okay, you know, yeah. I feel like by holding back on that, it gives this stuff more power when he does do it. Yes? No? Am I way off base?
It's a little bit of a flashback because I think he sort of lost Linus. Linus, it depended a lot on the blanket and the jokes with, you know, Snoopy trying to get the blanket and Grandma trying to throw out the blanket. And I think when we hit the 70s, it's sort of like he didn't want to do that anymore and didn't know what to do with Linus. So to me, this is kind of a flashback. Linus has not been doing this kind of stuff for the last 10 years.
Yeah, and I think it makes it more effective when he does it now. I think if this is what he was doing all the time, it would be a drag.
I just don't think he was planning that, you know, his fastball and his knuckleballs. I think he was more of a spontaneous cartoonist. Where I kind of feel like this.
Yeah,
today.
I'm kind of with Michael on that. He had this portion of processing like biblical stories and this sort of thing for every single week as a Sunday school teacher for years and years. And that overlaps with when he does the Charlie Brown Christmas. And then he stopped doing it, and he stopped having that public discourse of faith. I think that dropped way off. Because of that. And so it became less a part of his life. And so spontaneously, there are fewer times when Linus is sharing. Because you imagine if you're preparing for and then moderating a class every week, that's a big part of your life, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
If part of this has to do with what he's now processing, where he has a daughter now who's talking about those things with him, mm-hmm. It's now back in his life. And so it comes back up in the strip. Like Michael says, it's a little more spontaneous maybe in terms of how it bubbles up to the top of this, what he's putting in the strip.
Well, I agree with what both of you are saying.
You're
both right. No, you're both saying the same thing. I agree with both of what you're saying about that. But I guess what I'm saying is whether or not he planned, I'm going to use Linus less, or I'm going to use Linus a different way. The net effect is he has used him in a different way. And I feel that because of that, using him this way now is more powerful. That's all I'm saying. I mean, I don't know what his process was of, you know, I'm going to put Linus in 20% less strips. I don't think it's anything like that. I'm just saying if Linus was going on and on and on about nothing but philosophical things, nothing but spiritual things, it would have less power when he does it in this. And I think that makes this stronger.
Yeah. I mean, I'm glad to see Linus, you know, back in the action here, because he was my favorite character by far. And now he's kind of a bird who can't speak is a lot funnier in general. And this isn't really funny.
That's true. Yeah, this is.
Except I want to know about this linen waistcloth business. I mean, can you make a lot of money selling linen?
June 16th. Peppermint Patty's freaking out on the end of the dock there, and Charlie Brown comes up behind her. She says to him, "You heard what that speaker said, Chuck. He said we're in the last days." Charlie Brown says, "I know. I heard him say the world is coming to an end." And he sits down next to her. Peppermint Patty says to Charlie Brown, "Marcy said the world can't end today because it's already tomorrow in Australia." Charlie Brown turns to her and says, "Maybe we should go to Australia." Peppermint Patty says, "Don't make jokes, Chuck." I just think that one's funny. June 20th. Linus, Charlie Brown, and Eudora are sitting on the little folding chairs, obviously at another one of these talks, and Linus raises his hand, which... gets the other two's attention, certainly, and he says, "May I ask a question, sir? I don't really wish to interrupt." In panel two, Charlie Brown gets up and says, "I think I'll leave." Linus says, "I also don't wish to be rude." Just as a matter of curiosity, sir. And then we see Linus in the last panel. Everyone else has left. And Linus says, has it ever occurred to you that you might be wrong? And that's what I think is great about Linus in this instance, because that's a fastball. And it's no one else in the strip could have delivered it. Right. Snoopy used this punchline even. But it still wouldn't be appropriate for anyone else in this instance.
Yeah.
And it feels the most like Schultz.
But carrying on to the rest of the year, does Linus revert back to this?
No, I don't think. No, and I don't think it's a revert because I think this goes back to your original premise, which is he's a complex character. Sometimes complex people withdraw. I think it all works for me. Like, you know, Maggie and Hopi and Love and Rockets are apart for most of it, but you only really remember the times powerfully where they're together. And I think that it's the parts where they're far apart that make the other parts work. That's what I think.
Yeah. Yeah. There was like 3 years of
Love
and Rockets where they were on different coasts, essentially.
Right. Yeah.
You kind of forget that.
Yeah.
But I do think that because Schultz had already used this exact same punchline with Snoopy on the doghouse typing out the title to his new book about theology, and then he gives it to Linus in this, it's obviously Linus is dropping the bomb and the kids are getting out of the way. You know, this is the most like, okay, this is Schultz speaking.
Yeah.
He said it before and he said it again in two momentous strips that are well remembered.
Yeah.
And so this to me is like the climax in terms of Schultz having any say other than, you know, look out for the kids when you're dealing with really
difficult,
intense topics.
It does bother me that people who write for kids don't think about the kids as much as they should. It bothers me in a big way. You know,
so could you give an example of like, where does that manifest itself for you usually? What do you see in stuff for kids that you're like, well, really? You know, why did you do that?
When it seems like it's to me when it is obviously an attempt at making something popular or a franchise. Basically the opposite of something like Smile. Smile by Raina Telgemeier resonated because she wasn't thinking about becoming a superstar cartoonist with this. She was telling a story that mattered to her. It's not just the story. It's the story, the way the story is told, the drawings, all of those things it has to go together to make something that the kid you're giving something to the kid. The kid has to feel better or be smarter or stronger or whatever it is, or more empathetic. It's a story as a gift. Yeah. And if
versus a story as a way to make money,
advertisement,
be the cool new thing.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, do people write for children in order to teach them, in order to give them lessons, show them?
It's not just about teaching them, though. I'm not saying that. I don't want to do that. I'm just saying treat them as if you were. Okay. We're talking about David Foster Wallace. David Foster Wallace thinks a lot of his readers and he asks a lot of his readers, but you're going to get something. You're going to be better at the end of it somehow. You're not going to be a more moral person necessarily. You're not necessarily going to be a smarter person, but you're going to be changed and you're going to be given something that's going to stick with you for the rest of your life and influence you and affect you. That's what I think any good art should do. And that, honest to God, I know it's hokey and stupid and like, but that is what I tried to do for years and years and years.
Well, that's what attracted me to your work, Jimmy. Right. That's why we're friends now.
No, it was clearly.
I saw you putting that in your work.
But you clearly weren't doing that. You were not teaching moral lessons. You were just saying this is the way it is.
But I never said teach moral
lessons. Well, but that's what children's books used to be.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
And there's nothing necessarily wrong with that. I have a problem when people delineate what is art and what isn't art. And they say it's bad art if you do this or that, or it's propaganda if you do this or that. And I think there's a broader range of what art can genuinely be and good art can genuinely be. And I feel like we constrict it.
I thought we'd agreed early on that he was not writing for kids. He's writing for adults.
he said that, and I've kind of.
How old were you when you read it? When you started reading Peanuts, how old were you? 46, 48?
No, but Schultz
is wrong. He clearly wrote for children. He's totally wrong.
No, he was writing about.
As of 1966, he's highly aware that
millions of kids
are reading his strip, if not earlier. So, yeah, he said, I wouldn't even begin to know how to write for children. And he said that at a later date, which is absolutely fascinating and backs up what you're saying, Michael. But he had to be aware that kids were reading and how that affected him, I don't know.
It's absurd to think he's not. Well, I mean, was the Secretary of State taking the Peanuts lunchbox to school to work that day?
No, but,
I mean,
but that's idiotic. I hope so. Merchandising.
Okay. So anyway, June 21st, we'll wrap this thing up.
Okay.
Peppermint Patty and Marcy are at the principal's desk, and Peppermint Patty says, "Yes, ma'am, I'd like to use the telephone. My dad hasn't heard about the end of the world." This part actually moves me profoundly. Peppermint Patty worried about her dad. There's a couple of these sequences where that's what she's worried about. Her dad doesn't know the world is ending. That's amazing. I absolutely love that. So anyway, she says, "Yes, ma'am, I'd like to use a telephone. My dad hasn't heard about the end of the world." Marcy looks at something on the wall behind her and says, "Look at this, sir. It's a drawing of the new camp they're trying to raise money for." And then she continues, "It should be very beautiful. They're asking everyone to help raise $8 million. Which sends Peppermint Patty's hair a fluster, not quite as bad as it was earlier, but it shocks her. And then she turns back to the secretary or whoever it is at the camp and says, "Forget the phone, ma'am. Maybe the world will end tomorrow, but I wasn't born yesterday."
Yeah. Now that's that's politically smart to realize that people are trying to make money off of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's interesting to see that Peppermint Patty has a savviness to her that sometimes gets minimized in the strip because supposedly she's not good at school and this and that. But she's got, and certainly thinking that she was getting her degree from an obedient school, she's an interesting mix, right?
Yes.
She sees the world from a different perspective, and sometimes that makes her look really stupid in the eyes of the world, or at least in her eyes as the world sees her. And her teacher doesn't seem to think much of what she's doing. But there is this, like, Sally has her own street smarts kind of way of seeing things. Peppermint Patty does too.
Oh, I agree. And the other thing I think is great about these two strips back to back, who else has the characters to do this? He has Linus,
right,
who can take it on a spiritual level, and he has Peppermint Patty who has the street smarts, like you guys are saying, yeah, right, nice try. You're just trying to bilk me for money. Those are hard characters to have in the same cast and be able to. It's for the times I've said he hasn't stuck the landing. I don't think this is one. I really like these last two strips. Well, that was great. I'm glad we got to. I love going through the long stories and giving them the old once over with the fine tooth comb. It's really fun. I hope you guys enjoyed it too. We're going to take a break, you know, collect ourselves, make sure the world hasn't ended while we're talking, and we'll be back in a few. Stay tuned.
Hi, everyone. Have you seen the latest Anger and Happiness Index? Have you admired the photo of Jimmy as Luke Skywalker, or read the details of how Michael co-created the first comic book price guide? Just about every little-known subject we mention is referenced on the Unpacking Peanuts website. Peanuts obscurities are explained further, and other stories are expanded more than you ever wanted to know. From Albert Payson Terhune to Zipitone, Annette Funicello to Zorba the Greek, check it all out at unpackingpeanuts.com/obscurities.
And we're back. The world didn't end. So we're going to continue with July 19th. Snoopy, lying atop his doghouse, wakes up. He lifts his head and says, "It's morning." In panel two, he's really excited. His ears shoot skyward and he says, "I'm awake." Big grin on his face. Panel three, even a larger grin. Arms spread wide open and he thinks to himself, "The sun is shining, it's a brand new day, and I'm alive." Then he lies back down and says, "So?"
Yeah, right. that sums things up. Yeah, I mean, it's all the cliches coming out of the 70s where, you have to be happy and singing a song in the morning and dancing around.
Yeah. Although I'd argue so is also a cliche. It's just a surprise.
Yeah. But then really, does that actually change anything? No.
I would be doomed if I had to sing a song in the morning. I hate that I have to get up for 11 a.m. to record these podcasts.
Boy, there's an artist talking.
It's brutal. Yeah. Like, oh, am I a farmer? You want to record at 11? Jeez. I didn't get into this game to get up at 10:45.
Yeah, we have to make Michael and Liz stay up until the wee hours of the morning in Italy so we can record at our morning.
Yeah, I could not do this in the morning. I'd be going, ramble.
August 19th, Snoopy and Woodstock are sitting on the ground outside, and Snoopy says to Woodstock, "No, our kind doesn't get to vote. We don't have anything to say about what goes on in the world." Woodstock, with no reaction, just walks away. And in panel three, we see him climbing back in a cracked eggshell. And in the last panel, he encloses himself back up in an egg and just sighs.
And didn't this inspire a Paul McCartney album?
Back to the Egg.
What year was that?
79. So maybe it went the other way.
It was inspired by a Paul McCartney album.
That is one sad little moment there.
It's
like totally, totally stoic Woodstock in the first three panels, all the way into climbing into the eggshell. And then the little sigh.
That's a great symbolic representation of depression, too. Just like,
oh my gosh. Yeah. And again, this is, who else would have done this strip? Even at this time, Schultz is still, I think, going to places as influential as he is on other people. He's just got such a unique way.
Hey, dig it, though. It's an election year. Ronald Reagan's about to become president.
And it's probably during the convention.
Oh, yeah, that probably would be a convention thing, yeah. September 16th. Linus and Lucy are hanging out at the good old thinking wall, and Lucy says, "Look, do you think I enjoy bossing you around? Do you honestly think that just because I'm your older sister, I actually enjoy telling you what to do?" She's semi-ranting in panel three and says, "Do you really think I enjoy it?" Linus says, "Yes." And in panel four, Lucy turns to him and says, "How did you know?" Does that resonate with you, younger brothers?
Well, I mean, she actually did. Lucy obviously enjoys it. Obviously.
Yeah, I can't say my sister enjoyed it. It was more because I think in the case of my situation with my sister, there was a lot more on my side that would have caused any trouble for her. It would have been much more ballast than maybe Linus and Lucy.
Interesting.
Truth
comes out.
My gosh, absolutely. We were, I think we shared that pretty evenly, which in the end maybe worked in our favor because, we...
Yeah,
there wasn't like some lopsided relationship where one person was just,
It feels also alien to me. I can't imagine what it's like to have siblings.
The classic thing that I absolutely fell into as a kid that we were on long, long trips. We would travel from New York to Missouri and back twice a year, long road trips. And of course, we're in the back seat, right? And you've got the line. Anybody who's two kids in a family knows what the line in the back of the seat is, or at least most of you will, where you don't cross that line, which of course now is the reason why you want to cross the line.
Sure, of course.
You can format the other person and go as far as you can without getting in trouble with your parents who are driving. Yeah, that was definitely something I was guilty of for sure.
I remember my one friend who would torture his sister. They were all together. They're still great friends in their 50s. They're still probably torturing each other. I remember he got a sampling keyboard and he just pulled her hair so she could go, "Ow, Frankie." So he could play ow, 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 Frankie.
Oh, no. Oh, my gosh. That's
and I was like, I'm going home. Uncle
genius.
None of this happens and you could just read your Peanuts books. September 19th. Snoopy and Charlie Brown are standing in front of a television set for some reason. And Charlie Brown says to Snoopy, "You know what you need to do? You need to learn to obey commands." Charlie Brown says, "Sit." Panel three, Snoopy walks away. And in panel four, we see him sitting in a little lounge chair, which looks basically Snoopy sized.
And this is Schultz just knowing what to do in a strip. You said for some reason there's a TV. Well, they're indoors. He doesn't want to introduce a chair yet, which was often the beanbag chair or whatever. So what does he do? He shows us an angle of the TV set we don't normally see to show us that we're indoors. And it, when you see a TV set, what do you think of? Think of the chair they're sitting in. Yeah.
It's, gotta have a really comfy smart chair.
I see this strip as almost a model sheet for the new Snoopy.
It's Snoopy Watch.
Oh, interesting. Mm.
And, yeah.
And I think the main, first of all, expressionless, no mouth.
Mm-hmm.
The main drawing difference, I think, is that line from the nose to the neck.
Mm-hmm.
Where before he'd sort of make it peanut shaped in a way.
Right.
And now it just goes down, which makes him look kind of middle-aged.
Middle-aged Snoopy thing has blown my mind. I think you're like dead on about middle-aged Snoopy.
Yes, I think so that's a great insight.
I have to say, every time I see, though, like a new, in quotes, version of Snoopy, I go, oh yeah, I love this one the most. I really do. I like every one of them. It's crazy. Except for 1961. That was a debacle. September 20th. Charlie Brown and Linus are walking around and they're talking about what just happened. Charlie Brown says to Linus, "My dog never obeys commands. Other dogs will sit or heel." Charlie Brown continues, "My dog has only obeyed one command in his life." And in this panel, they walk past Snoopy on the doghouse and Charlie Brown says, "I once told him to stay and he never went home." This shocks Snoopy, who in the fourth panel sits up and goes, "How embarrassing. I've always thought it was an invitation." All these years later, we find out how he ended up being Charlie Brown's dog.
Yeah, that's why I picked this one. But also, you know, reading this a second time, there's a little bit of sadness here where it's like, all of a sudden you realize this thing that you assumed all along was this magnanimous loving gesture toward you wasn't that. But yeah, so he wasn't Charlie Brown's dog. He was the neighborhood dog, I guess is what Schultz said for a while. And then he becomes Charlie Brown's. And I'm glad he did become Charlie Brown's dog.
September 27th. This is a weird one. Interesting. Three panels that are kids on a bench playing some sort of game. Three panels with kids and also Snoopy. And they're screaming as they sort of rock back and forth. In panel one, it's squeeze. And in panel two, they're yelling squash. In panel three, they're swaying the other way. And they yell applesauce. And Charlie Brown goes flying off the bench. And Snoopy walks away from this scene and says, "When you're feeling low, nothing cheers you up like a few rounds of squeeze, squash, applesauce."
Did he make this up?
Never heard of it, but I assume he didn't, but I've never heard of it.
I had never heard of it either.
Seems like something kids would do, but I sure never heard
it of does.
It
does.
Now, there is somebody on Reddit, which is always a wonderful place to go if you want to get eyebrows tinged. I said, "I remember playing this singing game with my siblings where there were three people sitting together. The two outside people would squish the person in the middle repeatedly while singing squish, squash, applesauce." And someone else remembers it as crisscross applesauce. So it sounds like it was a thing. And it was a crisscross applesauce, spiders crawling up your back, cool breeze, tight squeeze. Now you've got the shiveries.
Weird.
Now, I've heard of crisscross applesauce with my kids, because that's how they would tell the kids to sit when they're sitting on the floor, because, you know, it's not good for a kid to sit like with their legs like a W, like, you know, kneeling on their calves and having the mountain behind them. So they tell them sit crisscross applesauce. But I've never seen this.
Yeah, this was totally new to me. I guess this maybe was something that Schultz experienced as a kid, or he saw
it might have been from the 20s or something. Who knows?
That's true. Yes. Who knows? You know, if you're out there and you've ever played a few rounds of squeeze, squash, applesauce, or any variation, wait, write and let us know. You can write to us at unpackingpeanuts@gmail.com.
He could have grandchildren at this point.
That's true.
Was married in 1969. So,
yeah.
Right. Yeah. He could be having a whole new round of kid experiences. Apparently, there was this whole range of adaptations that were in different areas of the country, I guess.
But number one that just took over, like, you know, Jingle Bells, Batman Smells, or whatever.
Robin
it seemed to be definitive. Everyone knew the exact lyrics. But
well, that's a masterpiece. You can't quibble
with that.
That's
true,
one.
Yeah.
October 27th, Snoopy is surveying his little scout troop of birds, and they do not look good. One has a busted beak, one has a black eye, and one might have a skull fracture because their head's entirely wrapped in bandages. Snoopy, in Scoutmaster mode, says, "Good grief! What happened to you guys? I knew I shouldn't have let you go into town. You all look terrible." And they do, but also adorable. And then in panel three, we see Snoopy asking Woodstock, "How about you, Woodstock? Didn't you get into it?" And panel four, Snoopy rolls his eyes because Woodstock is grinning with several missing teeth.
Which missing for a bird teeth. Is a trick because they don't have teeth. But it's worth it because there were two times this year where I laughed out loud. And this was one. I went, "I'll forgive him the tooth error." Unless he's an archaeopteryx, yeah. Which might be...
That's what our super listener, Jesse Fuchs, thinks.
He's an archaeopteryx?
Oh.
That he's a cryptid?
Yeah, birds had teeth. But anyway, great.
I think it's a beautiful
the
drawing.
The fact that he's smiling is great.
So cute.
Yeah, we've got a little bandaged beak. We've got a black eye and a little head bandage on the three other
The three wounded birds kill me. I mean, it's so funny. It's just funny drawing.
Woodstock looks just fine until he opens his
That's another band name, by the way.
Oh, what was it? I missed
three
it.
Wounded
three birds. Wounded birds. October 30th. Charlie Brown is on the phone and he says, "Yes, sir, I understand." Then in the next panel, we see him putting on his coat and talking to Sally. He says, "One of Snoopy's Beagle Scouts got thrown." Sorry. "One of Snoopy's Beagle Scouts got thrown in jail. I have to go down and get her out." "That stupid dog is more trouble than he's worth." Charlie Brown walks away saying, "Most of us are." And Sally is not pleased with that. She yells from inside the house, "Speak for yourself."
Yeah, this is taking it pretty far, right? He's getting a phone call.
There's a bird down in jail.
It's almost as if the person on the other end of the line is like, "Well, I've got some Beagle Scouts here." Because he modifies it a little. I think it later it's like he's at the Humane Society, but still.
Yeah. Wow. I love the guy. How am I going to fill out the paperwork on this one? November 8th, Charlie Brown has picked up Harriet and he says, they're walking around out in what looks like, you know, I don't know, the Appalachian Trail or something. And he says, "This is embarrassing. I'm supposed to be leading this bird back to Snoopy and her friends. And now we're lost." Charlie Brown, as he gives the side eye to Harriet, trying not to panic her, says, "I hope she doesn't panic. I'll bet she's getting nervous." But then he says, "Then again, maybe she isn't." And we see Harriet skipping along, singing, I guess, "Take Me Back to Tulsa."
That's an odd choice of song.
I don't know the song. What is it?
It's Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys from the 1930s.
Take wow. me back to Tulsa. I'm too young to marry. Take me back to Tulsa. I'm too young to marry.
Yeah, it came out in 1940. I did this 40. As an obscurity. Yeah. But it's a Western swing dance. Apparently super catchy. And I guess he was playing an old school song that he had maybe jazzed up a little bit. 1940 became super popular. And so they were always getting requests to play it. And so he decided to add some lyrics, which was what it became the next year. Take me
yeah.
back.
Yeah, I think it's his, I think it's Square Dance.
"I'm too young to marry" or something.
Yeah, and that's like the lyric.
Yeah, there's some kind of some silly lyrics in there.
Yeah, I've played that song many times. But how Harriet would know it, I have no idea.
Well, in 70, Merle Haggard did a cover, and Asleep at the Wheel did a cover in 73. So I don't know if maybe had access to that, or he was going back to the
well-known Merle Haggard fan, I think. I mean, just look at her.
yeah, I could see that, right? She's hanging out the window.
The bar fight. They might have heard it at the bar.
There you go. Oh, that's it. You got it, Michael. That's got to be it, right? The little birds at a roadhouse. You know, the imagery. Talk about turning this into an extended story and fleshing it out.
That would be a blast. November 16th, Lucy is holding the football. And she says, "Ecclesiastes, third chapter. Next panel, Charlie Brown walks up and she says, ah, just the person I wanted to see. And then she just begins quoting. To everything, there is a season, Charlie Brown. A time to be born and a time to die. With this, Charlie Brown walks away. Lucy continues, and this time she's holding the football, preparing for Charlie Brown to kick it. And she says, a time to plant and a time to pluck up that which is planted. She continues, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance. Charlie Brown has marked off his paces and he looks determined to kick this football. The next panel, he comes running towards it. And Lucy says, a time to love and a time to hate, a time of war and a time of peace. And the next panel is the inevitable "Ugh!" followed by wham. And then Lucy, holding the football, which she has just pulled away, says, and a time to pull away the football.
Boy, I can see that coming, except for Charlie Brown.
Yeah, why did he think, she was so distracted by quoting this that she wasn't going
to
notice?
I think he just is resigned to his fate and just like, maybe
if it's a season and the season has been the opposite all this time, maybe she's going to let him kick the football.
That's right. Actually, that's a good point.
But he doesn't really seem to be paying much attention.
Yeah, actually, this is actually probably my favorite football strip.
Really?
Yeah.
I think interesting.
It's a nice little rhythm here.
What do you think about the modern Lucy without her dress?
Oh, I never would have noticed.
Really? Yeah,
I like sweatshirt Lucy.
I do too. November 30th, Snoopy is standing on a scale and the scale reads fair. In the next panel, this is a Sunday. He is awoken by something. He's atop his doghouse and he says to himself, I hear footsteps. Is there no peace? And in the next panel, we see Lucy arrive at the doghouse saying, you dogs think you're smart, don't you? Snoopy, lying on the doghouse, says, spare me. Lucy continues, well, you know who's really smart? A pig. Snoopy, a who? Now, Snoopy is down from the doghouse and Lucy continues, people are always talking about how smart their dogs are. Well, just remember, she says to Snoopy, when you're talking about smart animals, pigs are really smart. Then she walks away, leaving a stoic Snoopy to contemplate it. And then in the next panel, he's back atop the doghouse, thinking to himself, if they're so smart, why are they pigs?
Great punchline. Yeah, that's got to be the title of the show. No, I this is another laugh out loud for me. I mean, it makes sense.
And this is Lucy kind of looking for trouble. We haven't seen a lot of Lucy just coming out looking for trouble like this, and she's definitely wanting to poke Snoopy here. She went to the trouble of stopping by.
Are the pants a thing now? Is that But yeah. she always wears pants from now on.
No, not always, but she will be wearing it frequently. And, you know, I think it's smart because that 50s dress was dated by the 50s, really.
Right.
So, you know, and it's such a subtle change.
Yeah, yeah. I appreciated it.
It'll never fully go away, the dress, though.
Yeah, she's looking a little stern at you think you're so smart, right? Well, we're so close to the end. I haven't brought up the anger and happiness index. So
oh, no, that's right.
Throw Let's it in it. Here. And just get a sense. What do you guys think? Is this, how did this year feel to you? Last year, we had 72 strips, which was, I think, near the all-time low of anger. How did it feel in 1980?
I think it's real low still, because I think, like Michael said, we're seeing a lot of the stoic, stoic Snoopy. You see the stoic Woodstock. You see Marcy as a very stoic character. I'm going to say it's about the same in anger and maybe slightly down in happiness, just for the sake of the stoicness factor.
Makes sense.
What about you, Michael?
Yeah, I mean, I really don't know. I'm just making it up. But I think the anger and happiness are probably going to be pretty close.
Okay, so yeah, we had 106 strips that were happy in 79, which I think is down from 78. So for the anger, it's an all-time low. Only 64 strips showed a character with expressing any sort of anger, down to 17%. This is a new era of Peanuts, I think. And I don't know what's going to happen into the 80s. But yeah, it is getting a little more stoic. I think his humor is leaning into being a little more stoic with the characters. He always was a guy who talked about downplaying reactions. And now it just seems like even instigations are less violent or less, right, you know, intense than they had been in the past. That's just where he is right now. The happiness, which had been 106 to 79, did climb up to 117 this year. So it's like about a third of the strips are showing happiness. So that's also been a thing. I think we've been over 100 for the last 6 years. And again, we said this kind of coincides with Genie, him being with Genie, and, you know, he's got a new life, and maybe that somehow reflects, I don't know.
Yeah. Speaking of Genie, we had her, if you haven't listened to that episode, go back and listen. It was amazing to have Mrs. Schultz on the podcast and get to talk to her. Just
so great.
Great. She was talking about one of the things he loved was the drawing the character. She specifically said Lucy with the big wide open black mouth. And if you just go back to September 27th, boy, that's like, that's a feast for the eyes of the big wide open black mouths. Yeah. Anyway, so we're going to wrap it up here on December 8th. Linus and Sally are walking to school, and Sally says to Linus, "I would have made a good evangelist." Linus says nothing, but Sally continues, "You know that kid who sits behind me in school?" She stops, turns around, and says to Linus, "I convinced him that my religion is better than his religion." Linus says, "How'd you do that?" Sally says, "I hit him with my lunchbox." That's just good stuff.
Again, it's interesting this year how many different characters had dealt with some aspect of religion due to that storyline that we were looking at, that Lucy is quoting Ecclesiastes, and now you've got Sally bringing it up. So that's unusual this year. And again, just my theory, but I think it's because he's talking with somebody in his own family about issues of faith when he was kind of on his own.
I think it's a good theory. You know what else I think would be real good? If you characters would continue to interact with us in between episodes. The first thing you can do is you could go over there to unpackingpeanuts.com, sign up for the Great Peanuts Reread, and get that newsletter telling you what strips we're going to cover. But we'd also, you could just email us at unpackingpeanuts@gmail.com. You can find us on Blue Sky Threads and Instagram, where we're Unpack Peanuts, and over on Facebook, where we're Unpacking Peanuts. And we would love to hear from you. Did you have a favorite strip this year? Do you have something else that you're excited about coming up here in the 80s? Let us know. We just love hearing from you guys. And, you know, if I don't hear from you, I worry. So with that, guys, I want your MVP and your strip of the year. Harold, why don't you go first?
Whew. MVP for this year. This is the most well-rounded year I think I've seen in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have anybody who particularly stands out this year.
Well, you got it, Harold. It's a feature.
I'm stalling for time here, but I think, boy, you know, I think I'm going to default back to Snoopy, just because I think Snoopy is way down in terms of his overall impact this year, which was kind of nice to see everybody. But I think Snoopy is, it seems to still be a linchpin with all of this, thanks to his relationship with Woodstock and the kids.
You can never go wrong with Snoopy. And what about your strip of the year?
Why don't you go to Michael and ask for his character?
Michael, what is your favorite character, your MVP, and your strip of the year?
Well, like Harold, yeah, it seems pretty balanced. I'm kind of floundering around trying to figure out who it could be. I mean, I picked Woodstock the last bunch of years. Woodstock didn't have too much great stuff to do this year. I really don't know. I guess I'll give it to Lucy because she's seems to have a lot of the punchlines this year.
It's a good pick. And how about your strip of the year?
My strip of the year, because this is not profound or anything. I just love that line, "If they're so smart, why are they pigs?" I got to give it to that because I love that line. I mean, it's, if you think about it, why do pigs muck about if they're so damn smart? Why aren't they lying on top of dog houses or anything?
Hey, if you guys have an answer to why pigs muck about, you could also shoot us an email for that. All right, Harold, you've gotten
all right.
Time.
I've gotten my time, and at first I was thinking I might go in the spirit of the broadened cast of this year. The scene where Pigpen is back in and gives Peppermint Patty a kiss at the dance. But like Michael, I just so enjoyed the writing on the strip very early on January 13th, when Charlie Brown receives a contract to shovel the walk. I think the writing on that is absolutely hilarious. He would never have written it any other year. He's just at that place in this year. And it is, you know, older guy stuff, but older guy funny stuff here. This is like the dad joke of Peanuts with a contract. And I enjoyed it very much.
I'm going to go with, for my MVP, I'm going to go with Linus, because I think this was Linus at peak form. And, you know, my strip of the year, I picked the one earlier with Charlie Brown almost being the world record holder for most depressed person, like most days in a row, and then blowing it. Yeah. I throughout this episode, I was like, oh, maybe I'll change it to that. Maybe I'll change it to that. But you know what? First thought, best thought, I'm going to stick with that one.
Okay. That's a great one.
Good.
So that is it. That is 1980. Another fun year. Another great time talking with my pals about my favorite thing in the world, which is cartooning, and my favorite comic in the world, which is Peanuts. And I'm so grateful that you guys keep tuning in to listen to us. We're coming back next week, and we have special guest Gary Groth, publisher of Fantagraphics and publisher of The Complete Peanuts. So be there. So until then, for Michael, Harold, and Liz, this is Jimmy. Be of good cheer.
Yes.
Be of good cheer. Unpacking Peanuts is copyright Jimmy Gownley, Michael Cohen, and Harold Buchholz. Produced and edited by Liz Sumner. Music by Michael Cohen. Additional voiceover by Aziza Shakrala Clark. For more from the show, follow Unpack Peanuts on Instagram and Threads. Unpacking Peanuts on Facebook, Blue Sky, and YouTube. For more about Jimmy, Michael, and Harold, visit unpackingpeanuts.com. Have a wonderful day, and thanks for listening.
We got to get way the far out of here.